Why does fat tend to collect in the midsection? Why is it so difficult to get rid of? Would it be enough just to do some sit-ups to get it going? Let's get into it.
Welcome to Scale to Fit, Fit in Your 50s. Just show up, make a plan, feel stronger than you can. Small steps lead to victory, you're rewriting history. Scale to fit, fit in your 50s with Marco Lindgren. Come on and join us.
Maybe I belong to the target group, but on social media I frequently receive advertisements from all kinds of gurus claiming that by following the instructions I can easily get rid of midsection fat, also known as belly fat. And I have to say, they have hit a nerve. Over the last 3 years, I think I have been doing everything right. I'm mostly watching what I eat, I exercise regularly, and on most nights I get decent sleep. And yet, that stubborn layer around the middle refuses to budge. Sound familiar? You are not imagining it, nor are you failing. There is biology at work here, and today I'm going to dig deep into the belly fat.
Yes!
What it actually is, why it seems to have a mind of its own, especially after 50, and most importantly, how to reduce it for good. And with this works as well, what I like to say, don't do nothing, do something and scale it back. First things first. When we say belly fat, we need to be a bit more specific. There are two very different types living in your midsection, and they behave completely differently. The first type is called subcutaneous fat. This is the soft layer that sits just beneath your skin, the kind you can actually pinch with your fingers. It makes up roughly 90% of the body's total fat. Subcutaneous fat is not harmless, but it is also not the villain of this story. The real concern is the second type of fat, visceral fat. This sits deep inside your abdominal cavity, wrapped around your organs, your liver, intestines, pancreas. You cannot see it or pinch it. It accounts for only about 10% of total body fat, yet it has a wildly disproportionate impact on your health. What makes visceral fat different is that it doesn't just sit there quietly. Scientifically, fat cells are classified as endocrine organs, meaning they actively produce hormones and chemical signals. Visceral fat, in particular, pumps out inflammatory proteins called cytokines, releases fatty acids directly into the liver, and drives a condition called insulin resistance, where your body stops efficiently using insulin to move glucose into cells for energy. In short, visceral fat is metabolically active in all the wrong ways. Luckily, it tends to respond to lifestyle changes and it's also influenced by sleep, stress, alcohol and dietary patterns. You don't need a full body scan to get a sense of your belly fat situation. Neither does the scale alone tell the whole story. A simple tape measure around your bare waist, just above your hip bones, after a gentle exhale gives you a useful baseline. Generally speaking, a waist circumference above 100 cm for men and 90 centimeters for women is a sign of increased health risk. That said, this is a starting point, not a diagnosis. Always work with your doctor for the full picture. It's never just one thing that causes visceral fat to build up. It's more like a perfect storm of lifestyle biology and hormones. There are a few main drivers. Caloric surplus is the foundational one. Consistently eating more calories than you burn causes your body to store the excess as fat. Simple in theory, complicated in practice, and we'll get to that in a minute. Not just how much you eat, but also the quality of your food has a big impact. Diets high in added sugars, refined carbohydrates, and ultra-processed foods are directly linked to increased abdominal fat. A 2024 review in the British Medical Journal found that people with the highest intake of ultra-processed foods had up to 49% higher odds of developing central obesity. Sugary drinks are a particular culprit, and alcohol. Liquid calories are easy to consume more of, are processed differently, spike insulin quickly, and seem to preferentially drive visceral fat storage. Movement, or the lack of it, is one of the strongest predictors of belly fat accumulation. Research from the university hospitals confirms that physical inactivity is actually the number one driver. The good news is that it is also one of the most powerful levers you can pull to reverse the effect.
Yes!
From a physiological standpoint, the impact of chronic stress is fascinating. When your body is under stress, real or perceived, it releases cortisol. Cortisol is your survival hormone. It is essential. But when cortisol is chronically elevated, something specific happens. Visceral fat cells contain far more cortisol receptors than other fat cells. So, elevated cortisol essentially signals your body to store fat right there, deep in the belly. This is what some researchers call cortisol belly or stress belly. A Mayo Clinic study found that sleep-restricted adults experienced a 9% increase in total abdominal fat and an 11% increase specifically in visceral fat, even without significant weight gain. Poor sleep and sleep deprivation raise ghrelin, your hunger hormone, and lower leptin, your fullness hormone. It also keeps cortisol elevated. The result is that you eat more, burn less, and store it right in the middle. And last but not least, let's not forget genetics and body type. Some people are genetically predisposed to store fat centrally, the classic apple versus pear distinction. Men tend to accumulate more visceral fat naturally. Postmenopausal women shift toward abdominal storage patterns. You cannot outrun your genetics, but you can absolutely influence their expression. Now, when you are grown up over 50, everything we just talked about gets compounded by some significant biological shifts that happen right around this time of life. And understanding these shifts is essential for working with your body rather than against it. After 50, we lose muscle mass at an accelerating rate, about 5-10% per decade. This matters because muscle is your most metabolically active tissue. It burns calories even at rest. Less muscle means a slower resting metabolism, which means you need fewer calories to maintain weight. The Mayo Clinic notes that men in their 50s need roughly 200 fewer calories per day than they did in their 30s, simply due to this muscle decline. If your eating habits haven't changed, the surplus has to go somewhere. For women, during perimenopause and menopause, estrogen and progesterone levels drop significantly. Estrogen plays a key role in regulating where the body stores fat. Before menopause, women tend to store fat in their hips and thighs. As estrogen falls, the distribution shifts toward the abdomen. Estrogen also has natural anti-cortisol properties, so as it declines, the body becomes more sensitive to stress and cortisol's fat-storing effects. Declining estrogen also reduces leptin sensitivity and disrupts ghrelin signaling, meaning appetite regulation becomes less reliable. This hormonal domino effect is not about willpower. Men aren't off the hook either. Testosterone declines gradually after 30, with a more noticeable drop after 50. Lower testosterone is linked to reduced muscle mass, increased fat mass, and a shift towards central fat storage. This is sometimes called andropause or low T syndrome, though it is more gradual than the female menopause transition. The physiology, however, points in the same direction: more belly, less muscle. And where it all converges. Life in your 50s is often genuinely stressful: career pressures, family dynamics, and health concerns. Midlife adults also report more sleep disruption. As we discussed, both chronic stress and poor sleep drive cortisol elevation, which drives visceral fat storage. And because declining sex hormones weaken the body's natural cortisol buffer, the impact is disproportionately strong. The cortisol stress sleep triangle is not a personal failing, it is a physiological problem that requires a physiology-informed solution. The reassuring part: visceral fat is actually quite responsive to lifestyle intervention. It tends to come off faster than subcutaneous fat when the right conditions are in place. So, let's talk about what those conditions would be. Before getting to solutions, let's clear out some of the noise, because some really persistent myths are making this harder than it needs to be. Myth number one, you can spot reduce belly fat with core exercises. This seems to be the message of many a social media guru. But sorry, not sorry, the crunch and sit-up crowd spot reduction is a myth. Full stop. When your body mobilizes fat for fuel, it draws from its total fat storage, not specifically from the area being worked. Crunches build core muscle, which is great, but they do not preferentially burn belly fat. Myth number two, it's just about eating less. A massive caloric deficit sounds logical, but it easily backfires, especially for grown-ups. Extreme restriction triggers muscle loss, further slows metabolism and spikes cortisol, which pushes fat storage right back to the belly. It is also unsustainable, leading to the restrict and rebound cycle most people know all too well. The third myth is cardio is the best fat burner. Cardio is important, but the research is clear that cardio alone is not the optimal approach, especially for our group age. A 2024 meta-analysis of 84 randomized controlled trials found that combining aerobic and resistance training outperforms either alone in reducing visceral fat. And resistance training's ability to build and preserve muscle gives you a metabolic advantage that cardio simply cannot replicate. And the myth number four. If the scale isn't moving, nothing is working. This one causes a lot of unnecessary discouragement. Body composition changes can be significant even when body weight stays relatively stable. Muscle is denser than fat. Someone can lose 2 inches from their waist and show almost no change on the scale. Track your waist measurement. That number is far more meaningful than your weight when it comes to health and visceral fat.
Yes!
So what you gonna do about it? Now we understand the challenge, so let's build the solution. I'm not going to give any magic bullets, nor will I introduce some 30-day challenge with bold promises. What comes next is a framework with 5 cornerstones grounded in solid science designed to work with the biology of a body over 50. Our aim is to create conditions in which muscle is maintained or increased, total fat goes down, and visceral fat is more likely to shrink. And before we go further, a quick note. If you got diabetes, heart disease, a history of eating disorders, or you are unsure where to start, work with your medical provider.
One.
If I had to choose one cornerstone with the most consistent evidence for reducing waste and improving visceral fat measures, it is aerobic exercise. A large systematic review and dose response meta-analysis in JAMA Network Open found that increase in aerobic exercise volume is associated with reductions in body weight, waist circumference, body fat percentage, and it also reports reductions in visceral adipose tissue area. A separate meta-analysis comparing aerobic versus resistance training suggests aerobic exercise is central for programs aimed at reducing visceral fat. Resistance training is still crucial, we'll come to that next, but if visceral fat is your big target, consistent aerobic work is a key driver. You don't need to become a runner. Consistency matters. Brisk walking, cycling, swimming, and jogging, they all directly target visceral fat. The current recommendation is at least 150 minutes per week of moderate intensity cardio. That's 30 minutes, 5 days a week, entirely achievable. If you're looking to accelerate HIIT, high intensity interval training, delivers impressive results. A 12-week HIIT program in one study reduced visceral fat by 17%. You don't need to go from zero to HIIT overnight. Build your aerobic base first, and remember, even daily walking is powerful. Don't underestimate it.
Two.
While aerobic exercise works well in reducing visceral fat, strength training is the insurance policy. Lifting weights, barbells, dumbbells, machines, or even body weight for beginners does something cardio cannot. It rebuilds and preserves the muscle mass you otherwise would lose gradually over the decades. More muscle means a faster metabolism, better insulin sensitivity, and significantly better body composition over time. A 2025 study from Deakin University found that high-intensity resistance training combined with dietary changes produced superior results in body composition for older adults with obesity compared to aerobic training alone. The four fundamental movements they used were deadlift, overhead press, back squat, and chin-ups. You don't need to be an elite athlete, you just need progressive overload over time, ideally with qualified guidance. Aim to 2 to 3 sessions per week. The best approach is a training plan that combines strength and aerobic exercises and which you can keep up with.
3.
And then the third cornerstone, nutrition. What we eat and what we are supposed to eat can get emotional and confusing. The baseline, however, is that to lose belly fat, you will need a consistent energy deficit over time. No deficit, no fat loss, no matter what the internet says. But how you create the deficit determines whether you can sustain it, whether you keep muscle, and whether you feel good while doing it. Basically, you should aim at 2 different targets. The first one is the calorie target. You don't need to count your calories forever, but counting for a few weeks or a month can teach you what your optimal portions look like. Here are some pointers to get you going. Choose a target that creates a modest deficit, often 300 to 500 kilocalories a day below maintenance consumption. Aim for a weight loss rate of roughly a bit under 1% of body weight per week. Faster isn't always better, especially for us grown-ups. Cut added sugar and refined carbohydrates, especially liquid calories, sodas, juices, alcohol. These drive insulin spikes and visceral fat storage directly. And increase soluble fiber, oats, legumes, vegetables, and fruit. Slow glucose absorption, support gut health, and help control appetite. The second target is the protein target. Overall, higher protein intakes often help with fat loss because they improve satiety and help preserve lean mass. There is randomized controlled trial evidence in older men showing that higher protein intake above the recommended dietary allowance was associated with a greater reduction in visceral abdominal fat in that context. There are also trials where protein supplementation during energy restriction was associated with visceral fat loss. And reviews describe plausible mechanism, satiety hormones, reduced hunger, and better body composition. So in practice, prioritize protein. Aim for 1.6 grams per kilogram of body weight a day. Protein preserves muscle, keeps you full, and has a high thermic effect. Your body burns more calories just digesting it. If you are strength training, protein becomes even more important. As the most simple approach, a plant-rich or Mediterranean-style eating pattern consistently shows the strongest evidence for reducing visceral fat and improving overall longevity. You don't have to go fully plant-based, just shift the proportions in that direction.
Hey, just a quick note before we continue with the show. If this episode resonates with you, please share it with someone who might need to hear it. And now, back to the show.
The Good to Know Corner.
One tool that can help with eating better is a food diary or food log, tracking app, whatever you want to call it. People either love them or roll their eyes the moment you bring them up. And well, both reactions make sense. So today we are going to dig into what the research actually says about journaling your food, the good, the not so great, and how to make it work for you without turning the tracking into a second job. In short, a food diary can help you spot eating patterns, improve self-awareness, and support goals such as weight management and identifying trigger foods. It is good for following energy deficit consistency, protein target, alcohol awareness, ultra-processed food reduction, and late-night snacking patterns. It can also feel time-consuming, overly restrictive, or even harmful for people prone to disordered eating. The easiest way to make it sustainable is to keep it simple, log food as you eat them, and treat it as a short-term learning tool rather than a permanent scorecard. Let's start with the upside because the evidence here is pretty solid. When researchers look at behavioral weight loss programs in systematic reviews from a wide body of studies, one thing keeps coming up. People who consistently track their food tend to get better results. Not a little better, meaningfully better. A food diary can improve your accountability and make healthier choices feel more intentional, especially when you are trying to change habits. And the interesting part, it is not just whether you track, it's how often you track. There seems to be a real dose-response relationship. More consistent logging leads to better outcomes. It is like training frequency. Showing up twice a week beats showing up twice a month, every time. Now, food diaries aren't only a weight loss tool. If you're dealing with digestive issues, energy crashes, or anything where you suspect your food might be a factor, a diary with some context notes, time of day, stress levels, or how you slept, can be a really useful way to spot patterns that you would otherwise completely miss. It can essentially be a detective in your own body. Okay, now let's not oversell the logging and tracking. There are some drawbacks. Even in well-designed clinical trials, adherence to food logging drops off over time. People start strong, then life gets busy and the diary gets abandoned. Tracking every detail perfectly can get tedious. That is not a personal failure. It is a very human response to friction, which is actually useful information for how we approach tracking. More on that in a second. Food logs are not perfectly accurate. People underestimate portions, use inaccurate caloric values, forget things, or let's call it what it is, log their best behavior version of what they ate. The research shows this pretty clearly. But I think that's actually fine, as long as you are using the diary as a trends tool, not an audit. You're looking for patterns, not passing an exam. And third, and this one is to be handled carefully. For some people, tracking food can be counterproductive. It can make you feel guilt, shame, or obsessive around food. There's a growing body of research looking at the relationship between calorie counting apps and disordered eating behaviors. Even though most of those studies are observational, so we can't say tracking causes problems, it may simply be more common among people who are already struggling. But the signal is worth taking seriously. If you have a history of a difficult relationship with food, rigid calorie counting may not be the right tool. In that case, something more qualitative, for example, hunger and fullness notes, could be a safer fit. And ideally, you are working with a healthcare provider alongside that. So how do you actually build this into your routine in a sustainable way? Here's what the adherence research points to. 1. Start smaller than you think you need to. Seriously, the number one enemy of food tracking is the all-or-nothing mindset. You don't need to log every gram of every meal from day one. Start with a photo and a timestamp. Keep it simple and light. Just log dinners and snacks. Build the habit first, then add detail only if it's really helping with your decisions. Track for 3 days and review your patterns. Continue if it makes sense. 2. Match the format to your actual goal. Weight management, you probably need some numbers, calories, portions, or macros, enough to make informed decisions. Symptoms tracking, ditch the macros and add context. How stressed were you? How well did you sleep? When did the symptoms show up? Mindful eating. Skip the numbers altogether and focus on hunger, fullness, and how you felt. Different goal, different approach. 3. Use anchors, not willpower. If you keep forgetting to log, don't rely on motivation to fix that. Pair the habit with something you already do automatically. Your first bite of a meal, clearing your dishes, brushing your teeth at night. That habit stacking approach is well supported in the behavioral change literature, and it removes the friction of having to remember to do it. Some food diary apps have gamified food logging. So if you are interested in keeping streaks and earning virtual gemstones, this might be your anchor. 4. Drop the perfectionism. This is maybe the most important one. The diary is a decision-making tool. It's not a confession booth. A missed entry doesn't break the system. A rough estimate is still useful data. If it makes you anxious, guilty, or fixated on numbers, use a less detailed approach. A simple meal photo log or a weekly reflection sheet can give you insight without the same mental load. What matters is the pattern over time, not the precision of any single day. So, food diaries, generally useful when used the right way, for the right reason, with a realistic expectation of what they can and can't tell you. The research backs that up. And like most things in wellness, the best version of the tool is the one you will actually use consistently, not the most complicated one. If you had tried tracking before and it didn't stick, maybe the issue wasn't the idea, maybe it was just the approach. Start small, keep it honest, and let the patterns do the talking.
The Good to Know Corner.
I have always felt that the advice to manage your stress sounds like something your dentist would say when they find a cracked tooth. But there's a valid physiological reason this is a priority, not a soft lifestyle suggestion.
4.
Chronic cortisol elevation is one of the most direct biochemical drivers of visceral fat accumulation. Mindfulness-based practices, including yoga, meditation, and deliberate breathwork, have measurable effects on cortisol. Nature walks lower cortisol. Social connection lowers cortisol. These are not nonsense for anyone over 50 dealing with belly fat. Stress regulation is a clinical intervention. Sleep belongs to the same fourth cornerstone. There is a systematic review linking short sleep duration to increased risk of weight gain and obesity. There's also research exploring sleep duration and adiposity in relation to energy balance outcomes. And cross-sectional data from the American National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey have found associations between shorter sleep duration and greater visceral fat mass. So, 7 to 8 hours of consistent high-quality sleep is the target. During deep sleep, your body produces human growth hormone, a key metabolic regulator. Poor sleep disrupts that, suppresses recovery, and keeps cortisol elevated throughout the following day. Sleep is where the work happens. Because if you sleep less, you are more likely to crave high-calorie foods, snack late, move less, and feel too tired to exercise. So for belly fat, sleep is often the difference between I know what to do and I can actually do it.
5.
The last but not least cornerstone number 5 is alcohol and ultra-processed foods, so-called belly fat multipliers. Alcohol makes it easy and fast to consume calories. It often disrupts sleep or makes it worse. In observational research, it's linked to visceral fat distribution. Studies have reported higher alcohol consumption associated with higher visceral fat measures, and a recent cohort study has found that heavy alcohol consumption is associated with a higher accumulation of visceral fat. So, to reduce belly fat, practically one of the easiest and best return on investment experiments is to reduce drinking frequency, keep weekdays alcohol-free, or set a weekly cap and track it. Ultra-processed foods are associated with worse fat distribution and ectopic fat in the liver, muscle, heart, and pancreas across multiple studies. Prospective analysis suggests that higher consumption of ultra-processed foods predicts worse changes in visceral fat over time. You don't have to eliminate everything, of course. Try a simple ratio instead. Make most meals minimally processed and boringly high protein. And keep ultra-processed foods as special treats, not as default sustenance. To bring this all together, measure what matters. The scale is a blunt instrument. Waist circumference measured consistently, same time of day, same spot, gives you a far more useful picture of whether visceral fat is actually moving. Combine that with how your clothes fit, how you look in the photos, and how your energy levels are trending. You will notice that progress is real even when the scale is stubborn.
Yes!
Belly fat, and specifically visceral fat, is not just a cosmetic issue. It is a metabolic one. It raises your risk of heart disease, type 2 diabetes, certain cancers, and more. And for people over 50, it is not simply about trying harder. It is about understanding that the biology has truly shifted and adjusting your strategy accordingly. The 5 cornerstones are aerobic exercise, resistance training, smart eating, cortisol management through sleep and stress, and moderate consumption of alcohol and ultra-processed foods. None of these are quick fixes. All of them are real solutions. To track your progress, use the right metrics and tools that support you on your journey.
Weekly challenge.
Your body is not broken. It is responding exactly as evolution expects. Your job is to give it the right signals. Start where you are, stack one change at a time, and be patient. Visceral fat, for all its stubbornness, is actually quite responsive when the conditions are right. So, over the next 2 weeks, why don't you track calories, protein, steps, training time, and alcohol consumption, and adjust the one cornerstone at a time? And here also applies what I like to say, don't do nothing, do something, and scale it back.
Welcome to Scale to Fit, Fit in Your 50s.
And I am Marko Lindgren. Thank you so much for tuning in today. If this episode resonated with you, please share it with someone who might need to hear it. All sounds are made by me, except the jingle that was made by Gemini. Send us your feedback via email to feedback@scale2.fit or leave a rating at podchaser.com. Check show notes at scale2.fit. All the links are there.